Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight. I might remind everyone to turn off your phones. It's great to have Jenny Macklin back at the Sydney Institute. She spoke for us on, from memory, two occasions. Once in the early years of Labor and opposition, and once in the mid-years when she was deputy leader of the opposition. I'll introduce her very briefly. Educated at the University of Melbourne, being the member for Jagga Jagga since 1996. Of course, in the Labor opposition years, she held a number of shadow ministry portfolios. In particular, of course, she was deputy leader of the opposition from 2001 until 2006. But now she's a member of the Cabinet and Minister for Families, Housing, Community Services and Indigenous Affairs. And tonight she's going to talk for us at the Sydney Institute on aspects of modern social policy. And I think it's the Minister's first major address on social policy in a very varied and demanding portfolio. So we're very grateful to have you here tonight, Minister Dean.
Thanks very much, Gerard, and thanks everyone for coming along this evening. First of all, I'd like to pay my respects to the traditional owners of the land on which we're meeting tonight, and particularly to the elders both past and present. And I do thank the Sydney Institute also for the opportunity they've given me to share the vision that I have for social policy, the social policy direction of the new Rudd government. Over the last week, in fact, we've seen the key role that social policy can play in maintaining our nation's economic security. When we were thinking about this speech, you can imagine we didn't think we'd be saying quite what I'm about to say. Decisive economic leadership in these very unprecedented times of financial turmoil, of course, is essential. And essential for both economic but also critical social policy reasons, the jobs, the prosperity, but also the social stability that's so important for our country. Families and pensioners, not your traditional economic levers, have been central to the government's early and decisive response to the global financial crisis. But good social policy is also vital as we prepare Australia for the future challenges that we face. We're all familiar with the implications of the ageing population. What that means, of course, though, is that we need to build a sustainable retirement income framework. We need to deliver a modern set of family policies, including paid parental leave, putting the best interests of children first. And this does require significant change to both tax and family payment arrangements. We need to develop new social inclusion strategies so that more Australians can work and participate in community life. And we must also continue sound, evidence-based policy interventions that close the gap between Indigenous and non-Indigenous Australians. Under our new government, social policy is an equal partner with economic policy. Of course, it hasn't always been like this. If I can just share with you, one of the great things about my job has been the sense of excitement and expectation about the government's social policy. I was at a conference in Sydney recently where people spoke openly of their relief at having a government that, as they put it, gets social policy. Of course, supporting people through difficult times is always vital, but equally important is anticipating and preparing for the shifts that will drive both the social and economic life of the nation. Building the capacity of all Australians to provide for themselves and care for their families. Done properly, social policy is about increasing participation and productivity. Let me assure all of you here tonight that for this government, social policy is part of the currency of a strong and prosperous country. And just last week, as I mentioned before, we saw how social policy can intersect with the economy in a very significant way. $10.4 billion as part of our economic security strategy, using social policy levers to strengthen our economy. And also, of course, it gives financial support to families, first home buyers, carers, pensioners, veterans, and people with a disability. There are very significant, complex social policy challenges as we set about our task to build a modern Australia. How to provide a secure social safety net which balances both adequacy, and we shouldn't ever forget adequacy and fairness. How to deliver services which encourage participation, promote independence, and increase people's ability to provide for themselves. To achieve this, we must have an innovative and flexible system with the ability to respond to the rapid and complex changes in the lives of both individuals and families. Inherent in this is the interplay between social security payments and services, the two levers that drive our social security system. Social policy goals need to be achieved through access to payment-based support and targeted services, but they need to be able to meet the complex needs of individuals. And the delivery of both payments and services has to take into account the different circumstances of the people that we're trying to help. They shouldn't just fit the institutionalised frameworks from which they've developed. Pensioners, of course, understand that the delivery of payments through the government's economic security strategy is part of our commitment to long-term reform of the system. The payments last week were just the first step. We are determined to do what is a difficult task to get that reform process right. And we'll deliver on a new system that has to be sustainable and underpinned by the principles of fairness and decency. And that will be done in the context of next year's budget. The review goes beyond those who interact directly with the social security system. I'm not sure that most Australians really understand just how large this system is. The magnitude of government spending on social security means all Australians have a stake in this review. Pensions and related payments being considered in our pension review represented expenditure of $41 billion in 2007-08, nearly 15% of the government's total expenses. The age pension alone is the largest single piece of government expenditure on its own. Millions of people and their families rely on income support, whether it's the single age pensioners who rely on the pension entirely. We know how difficult it is for them with rising cost of living pressures. Or the carers of sick children or ageing parents who are trying to juggle both their work and caring responsibilities. People with disability who need flexible, practical arrangements so that they can either participate in work or, if they can't do that, as much as possible in community life. Currently, there are 2 million income support recipients living in households reliant on income support payments for more than 90% of their household income. Almost 60% of income support recipients have a private income of less than $20 a week. 1/3 who have no private income at all, and this rises to around a half for people on disability support pensions and care payment. Households that are heavily reliant on income support also have relatively few assets. For example, most report they have savings of under $1,000. A new report by the OECD on income distribution and poverty, released just this evening, in fact it was embargoed till 6 o'clock, shows how we compare. Australia has the fourth highest relative income poverty rate for people aged 65 and over in the OECD. Pretty shocking, really, isn't it? The fourth highest in the OECD for relative income poverty for people aged over 65. An increase since the mid-1990s of 4.6 percentage points. By contrast, in most OECD countries, poverty rates for seniors have declined significantly. For singles over 65, the income poverty rate in Australia is 50%. This is the third highest in the OECD, compared to the OECD average of 25%. As a prosperous nation, we can and must do a lot better. Our down payment on pension reform just last week recognised the particular plight of singles, and for the first time was set at two-thirds of the combined couple rate, more in keeping with the relativities in other countries and the realities of life for single-age pensioners here in Australia. A government that dismisses the importance of getting social policy right, you can see from these figures, does so at great cost. One only needs to look at the previous government's bungled welfare-to-work strategy. In 2005, they said that their narrow approach would move people from the disability support pension and into work. I'm advised by my department that the budget forecast for the cost of the disability support pension will rise by almost $3 billion over the forward estimates. $3 billion because they got that policy so badly wrong. Evidence, if anyone needed it, that getting it right on social policy is certainly not an optional extra. It's not an add-on that you think about after you've done economic policy. And that's especially so in these times of global economic uncertainty. So to put it plainly, get it right and it's a positive for the economy. Get it wrong and the budget bottom line takes a very serious hit. The lesson is that taking a simplistic approach to social policy does not work. Getting it right certainly will not be quick or easy. But understanding, for example, the disability support pension and its complex composition is critical, and it does call for a sophisticated policy approach. There are more than 700,000 Australians on the disability support pension. These are critical issues for our future, and we need to figure out much better ways that we can support people. Just 6 weeks ago, the government took what I think is a pretty common sense approach. We're going to allow people on the disability support pension to volunteer to look for work without risking their pension in a new capacity assessment. It's early days yet, but my colleague, the Employment Participation Minister, Brendan O'Connor, tells me we're already seeing a modest but promising increase in the number of disability support pensioners seeking employment assistance through the Disability Employment Network. And to encourage further increased participation, Brendan O'Connor and my Parliamentary Secretary for Disabilities, Bill Shorten, are working on new approaches through a national mental health and disability employment strategy. Because encouraging participation for people with disabilities, and particularly for people with mental illness, is a very complex task. People who suffer episodes of mental ill health need the flexibility to be able to move in and out of the workforce. Carers too need a much more flexible approach that takes into account their caring responsibilities. They need individually structured care packages that help them both participate in community life and in the paid workforce where they want and need to do so. Caring for the people that they love around the clock, of course, is a very heavy load, often at a very, very significant personal cost. whether it's financial hardship, reduced education or employment, lower levels of health, depression, and the most difficult of all, the chronic grief or anger, are very much everyday life experiences for carers. Add to that the challenge of balancing caring responsibilities and work, it's no surprise that only 39% of primary carers are in the paid workforce, compared with 68% of people who are not carers. Yet half of all primary carers provide 40 or more unpaid hours of care per week, the equivalent, of course, of a full-time job. I just want to share with you a human story to really give you a sense of one woman and her family's life. Helen Johnson is a carer with a severely disabled 15-year-old son named Ben. She also cares for her 80-year-old father, who is deaf and has chronic obstructive airways disease. Quite remarkably, she participates in the workforce as much as she can. Her husband works full time. She says to me that she'd probably work more if she could, but when it comes to support for Ben, the system fails her. Helen's happy about the support that her dad receives, a $45,000 extended aged care at home package, which funds a full range of medical and complementary services as well as respite. But for Ben, who has far more complex medical needs and requires far more care, she gets very little. Helen doesn't understand why it is that she gets a comprehensive package for her aged dad, but can't get the same sort of support for her severely disabled son. And of course, she worries constantly about his future. That's one of the reasons that the government has embarked on a major disability reform agenda with the states and territories. For the first time, this has never been done before in disability, we're going to introduce national tools to identify service benchmarks, never before attempted. We're going to allow people to plan for their own changing needs, to identify people at risk, and to work towards a consistent program of service delivery. This reform has been a very, very long time coming. The sort of basic reforms that took place in aged care and childcare more than 20 years ago. Our disability reform agenda is focused on responding to the individual needs of people with a disability and their families and carers, reforming how our funded services can better meet their needs, and at the same time also looking at how other models of provision can complement the government's efforts. The approach we want to take will balance individuals, their families' desire to be independent. Most people, no matter their disability or their level of caring, want to be as independent as possible. And of course, they want to have a better standard of living. The challenge is to look beyond our traditional levers of payments and services. There are, I'm pleased to say, very innovative models around, innovative ways of providing long-term care and support for people with profound disability. One idea which was presented at the 2020 summit was the concept of a national disability insurance scheme for people who experience a catastrophic event during their lifetime. And recently we've had a Senate report on special disability trusts showing that when the program was established in 2006, it was envisaged that the trusts would support around 5,000 people with profound disability. 2 years on, and unfortunately, there are only just over 260 beneficiaries of 33 trusts. The concept is there, but it's certainly not working effectively at this point. But nevertheless, these are ideas and, we think, innovative models of support and worthy of consideration as we think about future provision for people with a disability, particularly those with profound disabilities. To help in this task, Bill Shorten has convened a disability investment group chaired by Ian Silk. And the group is providing options for increased private sector involvement and investment in the funding of disability services and related infrastructure. The ideas that they present to us will certainly help to complement the reform direction for government services, and I think most importantly, facilitate individuals and families in providing the extra support that they want where they can. Reform to make the system more responsive and fairer is long, long overdue. It's also why we're reforming eligibility arrangements for the payment called Carer Payment Child to help the 19,000 carers who look after children with severe disabilities or medical conditions. The reforms we're implementing overhaul the existing very restrictive assessment process for the payment so that in the future it will be based on the level of care required rather than rigid medical definitions of profound disability. So as with the other initiatives that I've outlined tonight, this new approach puts the need of the person being cared for at the centre of decision making. This style of approach being used here for this payment needs to be replicated across other areas of service delivery. What our carers need is a mix of payments, services, respite, in-home support, and the recognition that carers, most of them still women, are limited in their capacity to accumulate the superannuation savings that they're going to need when they get to retirement age. This is a disadvantage, of course, shared by many other Australian women whose working lives are often interrupted by raising children and their working lives characterised by low wages. So disability is another area of the social policy challenge that faces the new government. And we're determined, as I hope you can hear from what I've had to say so far, to reform what have been entrenched policies over the last long period of time and replace them with services and income support tailored to individual needs. Increasingly, social policy needs to help people cope with significant change and upheaval in their lives, to support them through difficult and often very different periods. So it's essential that our support structures are smart enough and flexible enough to deal with the modern reality of lives in transition. Just think about what it was like 40 years ago and compare it to today. For families, of course, many of the transitions are very predictable as they've ever been. Having a baby, going back to work after the birth of a child, raising children, children or young people leaving home, although that doesn't seem to be quite so predictable. Anticipating and planning, of course, for these life cycle events really requires a much, much more sophisticated and modern social policy. Take, for example, our commitment to deliver a paid parental leave scheme. Not only does it reflect our child-centred approach to family policy, it also is all about encouraging women to maintain their connection with the workforce, essential for our economy as the population ages. It's also my very strong view that it's in the best interests of children, because we all know that in those very early weeks and months, they're vital to giving children the best start in life. Of course, there are other transitions and changes that can't be so easily anticipated. They can be sudden, they can be catastrophic. Divorce, illness, the loss of a job, a serious accident. So what's essential in these catastrophic events is a flexible and targeted approach which responds effectively to individual people's needs. When families hit difficult times and their income is suddenly reduced, of course they're going to need income support. But that's often just the beginning of the story. To get back on track, to get back working, to get their budgets back in order, families often need much more than financial support. And just one example is their need for significant levels of financial counselling. And we've increased the funding for financial counselling in this year's budget. in fact doubled it, recognising that in turbulent times people do need these extra supports. I've spoken so far about one side of the social policy equation. That's the government's responsibility to make sure that support is adequate, that it encourages participation and promotes self-provision. But social policy is always, or always should be, a two-way street. On the other side of the social policy equation, there must be personal responsibility. The requirement for personal responsibility figures large in the development and delivery of the programs and services that we're focused on. It's certainly central to our child-centred approach to family policy. Just like I mentioned, for the first time, we're doing a serious piece of pension reform, disability reform, reform to carer payment arrangements. For the first time, this new government is developing a national child protection framework to tackle, with the states and territories, the shocking levels of child abuse and neglect in this country. We do want to take every possible measure to protect our children. Importantly, we recognise that parents and families have the primary responsibility for caring for and protecting children, and our National Child Protection Framework is structured to reflect that. One key element to the framework will give state and territory child protection authorities the power to recommend that Centrelink quarantines family payments. This will make sure that payments are spent in the interests of children and not on alcohol or drugs or gambling. We think that meeting basic parental responsibility is a reasonable expectation to place on families. Welfare payments should serve the interests of children. If it's not happening, the government does intend to drive reforms to make sure that it does. I certainly understand that measures of this kind are controversial, and those of you who've come in downstairs will also understand that. But from my point of view, they are necessary for one very simple reason. They work. Financial levers work. We only need to look at, and this was something done by the previous government, at the huge increase in immunisation rates following the introduction of the maternity immunisation allowance and the requirement that parents had their children immunised in order to receive the childcare benefit. We can see that as a result of that change, there was a very significant increase in immunisation rates in Australia. Financial incentives work. Immunisation coverage is now, we've seen it increase by almost 30% in just under a decade. And in the Northern Territory, where this has been very controversial, I have to say to you that there have been very positive results since the introduction of income management. Just the other week, I was in Wadair and had a meeting with a very large group of women who told me just how important income management had been for them. It has meant the difference between putting food and clothing into their homes, making sure that their children are better looked after. They feel that they can be more personally responsible for their children because of income management. Linking personal responsibility to financial reward can change behaviour. And so that is why we have done what we've done and continue the policy of the previous government in the Northern Territory, and why income management of a different type is also part of the Cape York welfare trials. We're also piloting income management and school attendance measures in a number of sites around Australia, some in Western Australia, in a suburb in Perth and up in the Kimberley, and others in different towns in the Northern Territory. And it's why we've decided to change the arrangements for the baby bonus. We're restructuring them in the best interests of children because we know that that's really what the money is there for. As I said earlier, we know that these decisions are not always popular, but we also understand that we have a particular responsibility to use them where we can to protect our children. These are another key element of what I hope I've demonstrated to you is a very ambitious agenda to use social responsibility to increase personal responsibility and responsible parent behaviour. We do need to challenge what have been long-held policy shibboleths and to use social security and payment levers as a way to confront high levels of dependency on welfare support and to tackle unacceptable levels of abuse. These are very difficult issues for us to confront, but we intend to do so. It's clear that social policy must be adaptive and must be able to respond to the rapid pace of change. Change that is increasingly complex and demanding, and change that has implications for every single Australian. Comprehensive, structural, social, demographic change demands ongoing agility and responsiveness from policymakers. So I think we need a fundamental rethink of our social support structures to make sure that they are up to the task of supporting people through difficult transition periods, increasing participation in the economy, and realising the full potential of all Australians. This is what we're on the path to do. Getting our social policy settings is about fairness, of course. It is also about the Australian way of life. It's about steering a course for future security and prosperity. I'm very pleased that social policy is now part of the currency of Australia's future and is back in business in this country. Thank you.
So we come to questions and discussion. I first should say thanks to CAUSE for the use of this facility tonight. And so we come to questions and discussion. Can this lead off? I saw a footage last night of the Prime Minister with a carer who was very grateful for the new payment. But of course, as you know, the new payments come about because of the likely effect on Australia of the financial crisis. There's going to be some kind of playoff against what you want to do as Community Services Minister and the realities of what's happening in the world. Just moving on to a point which you made about paid maternity leave, and it's coming as you do from your electorate, you've got a lot of small businesses there. If they have to go along with the Productivity Commission and make a superannuation payment as part of a paid maternity leave deal in the current climate, it might be a disincentive to employ people. How do you wear up what you're doing in community services with the likely impact of increasing unemployment as part of the world economic downturn?
Thanks very much. On the issue of paid parental leave, we are very conscious of the interests of small business. So whether we end up with the sort of proposal that the Productivity Commission has put forward or not really is still open for debate. You'd all be aware that they've released a draft report recently. They'll deliver a final report to the government in February. Whether that final report actually is the same as the one they've got out there really remains to be seen. They often make changes as a result of the discussions that take place between the draft and the final. And I have no doubt that the issue that you've raised will be an issue that they'll be cognizant of. We certainly are. So I'll leave that issue to one side. On the issue of carers that you raised, it's not actually correct to say that the decision we made was only made in the context of the global financial crisis. We have been very conscious of the need to improve support to pensioners and carers and others. And so it really was the coming together of two policy objectives. One, a very important social policy objective to increase financial support to carers in this instance, but also, of course, to get that money out in a lump sum to make sure that we sustain economic growth. So we had a dual focus. We have made it clear as a government that we intend to resolve these issues in the context of next year's budget, and that will happen. I think one of the interesting things, though, that I referred to in my remarks as well, that the Prime Minister heard from carers yesterday, is that they, yes, they do need financial support, but they also want all the other issues attendant to. Many of them do want to be able to participate in the paid workforce. And we figured out how to do that with childcare a long time ago, but we really haven't thought about how to do it in relation to those who have a very heavy caring load for somebody who has a profound disability or someone who's caring for ageing parents. And this is a really big challenge, I think, for us in the social policy area. They are particularly calling for us to deal with this issue of superannuation because, of course, if you don't get much working life, it's hard to have a decent amount of super to retire on. So a couple of big challenges for the government that we intend to address.
Yes, as a carer of some with mental illness, I'm really very pleased to hear the provisions you're talking about. But one of my major problems is that in the state government, there is a closure of psychiatric beds, and we're having fewer at this moment than we had at the beginning of the year with the closure of psychiatric hospital Roselle. The same policy has been carried out in South Australia, I understand, where Glenside has been closed. And it's absolutely crucial, if you've got a mental illness, that you be in a hospital where you can walk around. You're not flat in your back of bed like a lot of illnesses. And if you're in a hospital like a Missenden unit of Royal Prince Alfred, you can't get out of that hospital unless your parents come and take you, because the staff can't take you. And if I've had a friend, the parents came and took him, and he bolted. 3 days later, the police found him in the gutter in a terrible state. Mm. We do need psychiatric beds. You know, that is one of my major anxieties. If you get sick, will that person be in the hospital?
Yes. Yeah. It's, you're absolutely right that for people with mental illness, they need access to psychiatric beds, they need access to good community services, housing. So they have a different combination of service needs to people with other profound disabilities. And that's part of what I'm trying to say today, that we have to be able to respond to the different needs of people with different circumstances rather than expecting all people with disabilities to end up in similar types of service systems. So you're dead right.
Question.
Minister, I'm from the Benevolent Society, and well, welcome your comments about the need for change in Australia and New Zealand on social policy. As an organisation that has been involved in this area for nearly 200 years, we think there is an important need around ageing, for example, new models of housing and care models for older Australians. Mm. The issue of child protection, we're entering that because we think the system in Australia is really in need of new thinking. But my question goes to the opportunities you would see for government to work with organisations like mine and with the corporate sector. We find that there is a lot of really terrific thinking and innovation going on in working across different perspectives and sectors to have a new mindset about how we address some of these fundamental issues. And I think if the government can find the right levers around that, around social innovation, maybe some pilot funding and some clever and smart ways to do it, we could really break through some of the old models and some of the problems you've outlined this evening.
Can I just say I really welcome that comment and absolutely agree with you. And I'll give you a couple of examples of how we're trying to pursue these new partnerships. In the area of child protection, for example, we have been determined to work with a coalition of non-government organisations led by Families Australia, because we know that the services that are provided by the non-government sector are so critical to families who are struggling with the care of their children, but also, of course, to children who are removed from their families. And governments can't address these issues on their own. We definitely, I think, need to improve the relationships between the government services and the non-government sector. You make, I think, also a very valid point about corporate Australia. I think there are a couple of points I'd make about that. One is that many of the young people coming to work in corporate Australia today want to be involved in some program of social justice, and they often choose a firm where they can do a good job but also demonstrate their commitment to other people, to people who are less well off than themselves. And often corporate leaders say to me that this can make the difference between getting the top flight graduates and them going off to another firm that gives them other opportunities. So we want to be in there capturing that enthusiasm that's particularly coming from this great generation of young people. In the Indigenous area, which is also part of my portfolio, we are aware that many, many corporations are already involved. I know here in Sydney, I can think of, just off the top of my head, half a dozen companies who either support some of their staff going into remote communities, other companies support dance or artistic endeavours in Indigenous or less advantaged communities. Others are supporting sporting programs. Others are going out providing financial advice. So we're very engaged with figuring out how it is that we can, as you say, provide a bit of support, but really be there to sometimes open some doors for companies who mightn't quite know how to begin what they hope will be a very productive relationship in Indigenous communities.
Just taking up from that question and the one before, it seems that around the carers in Australia there are a lot of very enlightened families and people who form organisations with autism or whatever. I have a friend in Melbourne who's been involved with the Autistic Society for years, but they come up against the problems of bureaucracy, particularly in the state government. And they may have hugely informed ideas and whatever, but no one seems to collect this or even have some kind of dialogue with these groups and see if there are better ways to do it. And it seems that particularly in mental health, going back 20, 25, 30 years, there have been some very ideologically blinkered ideas of what should happen. Is anything going to happen, A, to get state and federal together better, in a better way, and also to tap into the experiences more of those groups that have been working with disabled and mentally retarded, or mentally whatever, affected people for years?
The whole
world, I mean, I'm
that's
sorry.
That's right. yes, there is. One of the things that we were able to achieve after we'd only been in government for about 6 months was the agreement around a new Commonwealth State Territory Disability Agreement, an agreement that covers $1.9 billion of services for people with a disability. And we have agreed with the states and territories that they will partner with us to really go down this big new reform agenda for disability services. Really, it's taken until now to say that we need national benchmarks. We shouldn't have different levels of services in one part of Australia compared to another. We don't have that in aged care or childcare anymore. We used to have, but we don't anymore. And finally, we're going to deliver it in the disability area, and that will be a huge change. It won't happen quickly. It's a complex task. Just developing the benchmarks themselves will be complicated. We certainly will be working with the non-government sector, and the same goes for the child protection area. We're working both with the non-government sector and with the states and territories. The states and territories in that area hold the statutory responsibility for child protection. We don't. But we have an enormous amount that we can do, some of it quite simple, that's never been done before. Just one simple thing. Centrelink has the address of every single person receiving a Centrelink payment. Some people have a tendency to not be letting public housing authorities know when they might be going off, not paying their rent, and they might be people that the child protection authorities are wanting to monitor. Centrelink's the place that knows where you are, and we'll be careful about the privacy issues, but it's critical, I think, that in the interest of children, Centrelink share that information with child protection authorities. Such a simple thing, never been done before.
Interesting. Thank you for the breadth of your approach. It's very refreshing. My question goes to whether you can give us more detail of how you're going to enforce reform against the child abuse, and would you bring into other states not with enough powers at the moment?
Well, we're doing a few things. One is that we've the Council of Australian Governments, just a few weeks ago when they met in Perth, agreed that for the first time Centrelink would be involved in the national alert system. So the first things we're doing is really saying what the Commonwealth itself could do to help the states and territories. So that's where we're starting. But what the states and territories are also working on right now is how they can actually share information better between themselves as people understandably move around Australia. We will be pursuing this issue of income management with the states and territories. We'll need their agreement to do that. We're starting, we of course are already very actively engaged in the Northern Territory, and the Northern Territory government certainly see the benefit of that, and we're about to commence, we hope, in Western Australia. As you know, there's just been a change of government, so we're having some discussions with the new government, but I hope that we'll come to an agreement.
Just
to
thank you for this evening. I'm wondering what sort of what your thinking would be on the education of parents in raising their children. Now that we've encouraged them to have more children, there appears to be an uncertainty in the minds of many, certainly when I was raising ours. And I'm interested to see what you think about it.
I think that issue of support for parents, parenting programs is critical. If I can just give you one, and we spend quite a lot of money on it at the, in my portfolio, very targeted, of course, to very disadvantaged families. One of the pleasing things which we've done in our first 9 months is establish a major new agreement with the states and territories focused on Indigenous families. And what we're doing is we've put a package of services together. It's really my message tonight, I suppose, is let's not see these things all as different. Let's think about what it's like for young parents having a baby. What are the critical things to make sure that a new baby comes into the world healthy and has a chance to grow up in a functioning family? We're putting, in this new program, we're putting a lot of effort into teenage parenting. Just to let you know, the Indigenous Australians have the highest level of teenage pregnancy in the developed world. So we have a big task in front of us to encourage those girls and the boys to stay on at school and do the things that teenagers normally do rather than starting a family. So teenage pregnancy issues is one part. Antenatal care, very important. We all know now from excellent medical research that if you don't get it right before the baby's born, then the baby starts such a long way behind. Maternal and child health, once again, we know it works. Make sure that people go regularly, that mum takes the baby regularly for the checks that they need. And then parenting programs, recognising, particularly with young people, that they don't necessarily know how to raise a child. I can remember long time ago, but it was pretty scary first time round. And so parenting programs are critical. And the next part is early childhood education. We know from, once again, all the evidence, so much of the brain development happens before a child gets to school. We hold the wooden spoon for preschool education in the developed world. Not a very good piece of evidence when you think about how well off we are. We're determined to make sure that every single four-year-old in Australia gets a preschool education, and we're going to do that over the next 5 years. It's going to take time, but it's one of those other areas that we're determined to change. We see parenting in there, in that group of very important supports for families.
Look, I'm just interested to know, Tim McDonald from the ABC, I should identify myself, but why is it that the government...
I'd like to stand up so people can hear you.
Sure. Why is it that the government thinks that that this is a very important portfolio? I don't think anybody disputes that, but there's many places that the government could put money that would have some kind of a multiplier effect on the economy. you know, just an across-the-board tax cut for one, infrastructure projects, health, there's, you know, the list goes on and on. Why is the Rudd government convinced that this is going to have the greatest effect economically, if you just put aside the humanitarian reasons which are doing this?
The question was, why has the government decided to put money into the economic security strategy in the way that we have, rather than spending it on tax cuts or infrastructure? The reason we've had very strong advice from the Treasury to go early, to go hard, and to go households. And the reason we've wanted to give it to households in a lump sum, rather than a fortnightly tax cut or a payment, is because we want to stimulate the economy now. That's it in a nutshell. Okay.
Can I just ask the final question, because we're virtually on time? You covered matters relating to the Northern Territory intervention. We have Sue Gordon here in this room, actually, about 6 months ago, talking about that. It's been reformed. What are you thinking about? I know it's still being discussed in interim reports and whatever else, but what's your general thinking about the way the Rudd government's likely to go on that when you're making final decisions? And how long do you think your decisions are going to last for? Are you going to review them again? Just give us a summation of what's going on.
Sure. Some of you would be aware that we've just conducted the first major review of the Northern Territory emergency response. It was done by Peter Yu and Marcia Ella Duncan from Sydney here, and Bill Gray, and they've just presented a report to the government, which I made public just a week or so ago. They recommend, and I think this is probably the most substantive point, that the level of disadvantage is so deep and so entrenched in Northern Territory Indigenous communities that there is a need for long-term intervention to address this disadvantage. So that, I think, is probably the most fundamental point that needs to be made and has been heard loud and clear by the government. There are, of course, many recommendations that the review board has made, which the government's looking at right now, and will respond fairly quickly to those. But the message about the enormous level of disadvantage, you'd be familiar with the figures, the 17-year life expectancy gap, the very high levels of violence and abuse, the very high levels of alcohol abuse, the problems with infant mortality, children not going to school. There are around 2,000 children in the Northern Territory not even enrolled to go to school. The levels of attendance are appalling. So there is an enormous amount more to be done, and it's our task to get on with it.
Many thanks, Minister. Take a second, please.
Thank you.
Well, I'll be very brief. I think the Minister said there are many complexities in her portfolio, and that's certainly true. The area she deals with is families, housing, community services and Indigenous affairs are all very substantial responsibility in their own right. Since about the last decade or so, Jenny Macklin's come to the Sydney Institute, and I think what we've observed in the past is what we've observed tonight. She's got bucket loads of common sense, and that's really what's required in this kind of very exacting, very demanding, but hugely important position, covering some of the largest expenditures of the Commonwealth Government. So thanks for an important address tonight. Best wishes in your demanding role over the next years. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Well done.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.